Chapter 30. He moved to his place through a storm of applause, which the sheriff stopped, and also made the people sit down, for they were all standing and struggling to see, of course. Court, jury, sheriff, and everybody had been too absorbed in observing Wilson's performance to attend to the audience earlier. "Now then," said Wilson, "I have here the natal autographs of the two children thrown up to 10 times the natural size by the pantograph, so that anyone who can see at all can tell the markings apart at a glance. We will call the children A and B. Here are A's finger marks, taken at the age of 5 months. Here they are again, taken at 7 months." Tom started. "They are alike, you see. Here are B's at 5 months, and also at 7 months. They too, exactly copy each other, but the patterns are quite different from A's, you observe. I shall refer to these again presently, but we will turn them face down now. Here, thrown up 10 sizes, are the natal autographs of the two persons who are here before you accused of murdering Judge Driscoll. I made these pantograph copies last night, and will so swear when I go upon the witness stand. I ask the jury to compare them with the finger marks of the accused upon the window panes, and tell the court if they are the same." He passed a powerful magnifying glass to the foreman. One juryman after another took the cardboard and the glass, and made the comparison. Then the foreman said to the judge, "Your Honor, we are all agreed that they are identical." Wilson said to the foreman, "Please turn that cardboard face down, and take this one, and compare it searchingly, by the magnifier, with the fatal signature upon the knife handle, and report your finding to the court." Again the jury made minute examinations, and again reported, "We find them to be exactly identical, Your Honor." Wilson turned toward the counsel for the prosecution, and there was a clearly recognizable note of warning in his voice when he said, "May it please the court, the state has claimed, strenuously and persistently, that the bloodstained fingerprints upon that knife handle were left there by the assassin of Judge Driscoll. You have heard us grant that claim, and welcome it." He turned to the jury. "Compare the fingerprints of the accused with the fingerprints left by the assassin and report." The comparison began. As it proceeded, all movement and all sound ceased, and the deep silence of an absorbed and waiting suspense settled upon the house, and when at last the words came, "They do not even resemble," a thunder crash of applause followed and the house sprang to its feet, but was quickly repressed by official force and brought to order again. Tom was altering his position every few minutes now, but none of his changes brought repose, nor any small trifle of comfort. When the house's attention was become fixed once more, Wilson said gravely, indicating the twins with a gesture, "These men are innocent, I have no further concern with them." Another outbreak of applause began, but was promptly checked. "We will now proceed to find the guilty." Tom's eyes were starting from their sockets. Yes, it was a cruel day for the bereaved youth, everybody thought. "We will return to the infant autographs of A and B. I will ask the jury to take these large pantograph facsimiles of A's marked 5 months and 7 months. Do they tally?" The foreman responded, "Perfectly. Now examine this pantograph, taken at 8 months, and also marked A. Does it tally with the other two?" The surprised response was, "No, they differ widely." "You are quite right. Now take these two pantographs of B's autograph, marked 5 months and 7 months. Do they tally with each other?" "Yes, perfectly." "Take this third pantograph marked B, 8 months. Does it tally with B's other two?" "By no means." "Do you know how to account for those strange discrepancies?" "I will tell you. For a purpose unknown to us, but probably a selfish one, somebody changed those children in the cradle." This produced a vast sensation, naturally. Roxana was astonished at this admirable guess, but not disturbed by it. To guess the exchange was one thing, to guess who did it quite another. Pudd'nhead Wilson could do wonderful things, no doubt, but he couldn't do impossible ones. Safe? She was perfectly safe. She smiled privately. Between the ages of 7 months and 8 months, those children were changed in the cradle. He made one of this effect - collecting pauses, and added, "And the person who did it is in this house." Roxy's pulses stood still. The house was thrilled, as with an electric shock, and the people half rose, as if to seek a glimpse of the person who had made that exchange. Tom was growing limp. The life seemed oozing out of him. Wilson resumed. A was put into B's cradle in the nursery. B was transferred to the kitchen, and became a Negro and a slave. Sensation, confusion of angry ejaculations, but within a quarter of an hour he will stand before you white and free. Burst of applause, checked by the officers. From 7 months onward until now, A has still been a usurper, and in my finger record he bears B's name. Here's his pantograph at the age of 12. Compare it with the assassin's signature upon the knife handle. Do they tally? The foreman answered. To the minutest detail. Wilson said, solemnly. The murderer of your friend and mine, York Driscoll of the generous hand, and the kindly spirit sits in among you. Valet de chamber, Negro and slave, falsely called Thomas A. Beckett Driscoll, make upon the window the fingerprints that will hang you. Tom turned his ashen face imploring toward the speaker, made some impotent movements with his white lips, then slid limp and lifeless to the floor. Wilson broke the odd silence with the words. There is no need. He has confessed. Roxy flung herself upon her knees, covered her face with her hands, and out through her sobs the words struggled. The Lord have mercy on me, poor miserable sinner that I is. The clock struck 12. The court rose. The new prisoner, handcuffed, was removed. Conclusion: it is often the case that the man who can tell a lie thinks he is the best judge of one. Pudd'nhead Wilson's Calendar, October 12, The Discovery. It was wonderful to find America, but it would have been more wonderful to miss it. Pudd'nhead Wilson's Calendar, The town sat up all night to discuss the amazing events of the day and swap guesses as to when Tom's trial would begin. Troop after troop of citizens came to serenade Wilson and require a speech and shout themselves hoarse over every sentence that fell from his lips, for all his sentences were golden now, all were marvelous. His long fight against hard luck and prejudice was ended. He was a made man for good. And as each of these roaring gangs of enthusiasts marched away, some remorseful member of it was quite sure to raise his voice and say, "And this is the man the likes of us have called a Pudd'nhead for more than 20 years. He has resigned from that position, friends. Yes, but it isn't vacant we're elected." The twins were heroes of romance now, and with rehabilitated reputations. But they were weary of Western adventure, and straightway retired to Europe. Roxy's heart was broken. The young fellow upon whom he had inflicted 23 years of slavery continued the false heir's pension of $35 a month to her, but her hurts were too deep for money to heal. The spirit in her eye was quenched, her martial bearing departed with it, and the voice of her laughter ceased in the land. In her church and its affairs she found her only solace. The real heir suddenly found himself rich and free, but in a most embarrassing situation. He could neither read nor write, and his speech was the basest dialect of the Negro quarter. His gait, his attitudes, his gestures, his bearing, his laugh, all were vulgar and uncouth. His manners were the manners of a slave. Money and fine clothes could not mend these defects, or cover them up. They only made them more glaring, and the more pathetic. The poor fellow could not endure the terrors of the white man's parlor, and felt at home, and at peace nowhere but in the kitchen. The family pew was a misery to him, yet he could never more enter into the solacing refuge of the Igor gallery that was close to him for good and all. But we cannot follow his curious fate further, that would be a long story. The false heir made a full confession, and was sentenced to imprisonment for life. But now a complication came up. The Percy Driscoll estate was in such a crippled shape when its owner died that it could pay only 60% of its great indebtedness, and was settled at that rate. But the creditors came forward now, and complained that inasmuch as through an error for which they were in no way to blame, the false heir was not inventoried at the time with the rest of the property, great wrong and loss had thereby been inflicted upon them. They rightly claimed that Tom was lawfully their property, and had been so for 8 years, that they had already lost sufficiently in being deprived of his services during that long period, and ought not to be required to add anything to that loss. That if he had been delivered up to them in the first place, they would have sold him, and he could not have murdered Judge Driscoll. Therefore it was not that he had really committed the murder, the guilt lay with the erroneous inventory. Everybody saw that there was reason in this. Everybody granted that, if Om were white and free, it would be unquestionably right to punish him. It would be no loss to anybody, but to shut up a valuable slave for life, that was quite another matter. As soon as the governor understood the case, he pardoned Tom at once, and the creditors sold him down the river. Author's note to those extraordinary twins: a man who is not born with the novel writing gift has a troublesome time of it when he tries to build a novel. I know this from experience. He has no clear idea of his story. In fact, he has no story. He merely has some people in his mind, and an incident or two, also a locality, and he trusts he can plunge those people into those incidents with interesting results. So he goes to work. To write a novel? No, that is a thought which comes later. In the beginning he is only proposing to tell a little tale, a very little tale, a 6-page tale. But as it is a tale which he is not acquainted with, and can only find out what it is by listening as it goes along telling itself, it is more than apt to go on and on till it spreads itself into a book. I know about this, because it has happened to me so many times. And I have noticed another thing, that as the short tale grows into the long tale, the original intention or motif is apt to get abolished, and find itself superseded by a quite different one. It was so in the case of a magazine sketch which I once started to write, a funny and fantastic sketch about a prince and a pauper. It presently assumed a grave cast of its own accord, and in that new shape spread itself out into a book. Much the same thing happened with Pudd'nhead Wilson. I had a sufficiently hard time with that tale, because it changed itself from a farce to a tragedy, while I was going along with it, a most embarrassing circumstance. But what was a great deal worse was, that it was not one story, but two stories tangled together. And they obstructed and interrupted each other at every turn, and created no end of confusion and annoyance. I could not offer the book for publication, for I was afraid it would unseat the reader's reason. I did not know what was the matter with it, for I had not noticed, as yet, that it was two stories in one. It took me months to make that discovery. I carried the manuscript back and forth across the Atlantic 2 or 3 times, and read it and studied over it on shipboard. And at last I saw where the difficulty lay. I had no further trouble. I pulled one of the stories out by the roots, and left the other a kind of literary Caesarean operation. Would the reader care to know something about the story which I pulled out? He has been told many a time how the born-and-trained novelist works. Won't he let me round and complete his knowledge by telling him how the jackleg does it? Originally the story was called Those Extraordinary Twins. I meant to make it very short. I had seen a picture of a youthful Italian, Rick or Reeks, which was or which were on exhibition in our cities, a combination consisting of 2 heads, and 4 arms joined to a single body, and a single pair of legs, and I thought I would write an extravagantly fantastic little story with this freak of nature for hero or heroes, a silly young miss for heroine, and 2 old ladies and 2 boys for the minor parts. I lavishly elaborated these people and their doings, of course. But the tape kept spreading along and spreading along, and other people got to intruding themselves, and taken up more and more room with their talk and their affairs. Among them came a stranger named Pudd'nhead Wilson, and a woman named Roxana, and presently the doings of these two pushed up into prominence a young fellow named Tom Driscoll, whose proper place was away in the obscure background. Before the book was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.